This is Sandra Schimmelhorn, testing for sound. Okay. We are recording now. This is Mason Sabamyan, the second part of his oral history.
So, I already mentioned that I was regional examiner in the period I was regional examiner, and then I was asked to be on the TAC, which I guess the word is chosen. There's a new group of us, and there's 9 TAC members, and there were 3 offices that were, this is all new at the time, and that was in 1999. And so I became part of the NAGOM group at that time. There's the 3 members, there's a total of 9 on the TAC at that time. And we had 3 in each office, and the NAGOM group was the office that I was in on. And then the Wigan Boo, your husband, was on. And then the Shingon Boo, maybe. No, he's Wigan.
Wigan, for sure.
And so those 3 offices. And so that was 1999. And then that was a 3-year term. And then we were reassigned for another 3 years. But Quentin Huangqi died in 2002. And because of that, they needed a new chairman of the TAC because his son became the president and the Grand Master then of our association. So I was then appointed is the right word for all those offices.
Yes, sir.
Then I was appointed as chairman of the TAC. And then the Fukienian was formed in July 23rd of 2005, and a new TAC was assigned, and I was put on the Fukienian in July 23rd of 05, and then appointed as its chairman. And the rest is just things that I'm really proud of that took place through the years. May I go through that?
Yes, sir. Please, sir. Yes.
In chronological order, in 1982, I designed and produced the California patches for the team members in Region 9. In 1985, for the national championships, Master Walsh asked me to handle the awards, and I got approval for an overall grand championship award for the person who won both forms and sparring. And Master Lisa Kozak was in a third dan then, and she won that.
Sure.
And I'm very happy that. But I also found that the trophies, they were dishes, silver plated trays, and we had them engraved, and they had to be carefully selected because my friend who did the engraving said if they were shallow plating, then it would show a different color. I guess when you engrave them, we went through a lot of problems. Also, I was able to start awarding 2 third place awards, and that was the first time that was done in the 1985 National Championship. I designed the medals for the Nationals in Region 9, and also they had a good discipline award that was a medal that was made probably in Korea. I redesigned that and had that produced. I was no longer using that, of course, but the good discipline medals.
I remember those, sir.
And I still have a few of those left over that are kind of fun to look at.
Yes, sir.
I never got one. But in 1986, I designed and produced the USA patches for the team members attending the international championships in England. And of course, I was board of directors, chairman then, and so we had a national advertisement in Black Book magazine that the concept was to make ourselves more known, but advertising all the studios, and that increased enrollment that year, and our budget really increased tremendously from 125,000 to $500,000. Because of that, it's amazing how many new studios we had.
Sure.
Because of that, but it was a drop off after that. It could be because a lot of new studios realized they had to jump through a few hoops that were difficult. They learned a whole bunch of new hyung and so
sure.
And I didn't preside over it, but initiated the first national summer camp There was other summer camps held in Region 2 and California also, but they weren't national, considered a national summer camp. And so on July 25th in 1986, we had the first national summer camp in upstate New York.
Phoenicia.
Yes,
Phoenicia.
Yes, I went to one the following year, but I didn't go there.
Yes, sir.
In 1989, this is where it gets into good stuff. Now, this is trivial at first, but I noticed before that we used a score sheet, a piece of paper that had you had to mark all the scores of the participants as they did it, and these were all thrown away after each bout and pretty much became trash.
Yes, sir.
I realized that it would be simpler, most simple, to use blackboards. So I bought a bunch of blackboards, and so in 1989, in Anaheim, we started using chalkboards in each ring. I think I'm still doing that, I hope, still.
Yes, yes, sir.
Instead of the paperwork, but
so.
That
yes.
We have a scorekeeper that writes the score, and that way the referee could see the scores as they're done. I started doing that. I still have the original blackboards, too, in my garage.
Oh.
But since then, other people have.
Yes, sir. Other people do that. It was a good innovation because people picked up on it. And
I needed it real bad. I needed it. And even still today, you have to watch them because the kids, you don't know. They hold it so they can see it.
Nobody yes, sir.
But you know how it goes. Sometimes it'll be upside down. It's really funny. But anyway, I'm very happy that that was accepted.
Yes, sir.
But my pride and joy, based upon an injury that I got in a tournament in California Police Olympics, actually it was an International Police Olympics held in Long Island. I got in 1980, I got 15 stitches in my head from being knocked out and laying on my head on a hardwood floor. So I had a personal thing about safety gear since from then on.
Yes,
and I had a heck of a time trying to get my seniors to agree, or the board, or anybody to want to go along with that. And their primary objection was it looked too much like another art we won't mention. And so I kept trying to tell people, well, it's called safety gear or safety equipment, and what you're telling me is you're not interested in being safe. And so I just kept pushing. Well, when I was elected chairman of the board again in 1989, this is after another term where I wasn't, because I had to do split. In 1986 and 87, I was chairman of the board. In 88, Mr. Muniz was. In 89, I was elected again. I think Mr. Pryor was elected for 89. So in 1990, I was chairman of the board, and I had a little more influence to get that change. And so I initiated the use, and it was accepted. And as long as I was on a roll, I also snuck in the hand gear. I figured as long as they're going to accept that, then we can go hand gear in it. But it wasn't totally accepted, and only I think they were interested. It was like optional for adults and children must. So we purchased some for the kids, and all the kids wore the headgear then in the 1990 championships. I had a heck of a time getting our Region 9 to go along with that. But soon it was accepted. I think there was a couple of injuries when they didn't have it. And you said, well,
sure.
I must be right.
Sure.
But that's the thing I'm most proud of. And a newsletter article that was supposed to be mentioned, that line was omitted somehow. Mm-hmm. So the way it reads is, the thing I'm most proud of is the initiation of the Region 9 championships, which is not only incorrect,
sure.
But not what I said.
Yes, sir.
Anyway, so the other things are, let's see, and then later on in the year 2000, I designed and produced the Region 9 patch that we're using now. That is it, pretty much.
That's wonderful, Heather. Thank you. That's really wonderful. Let me play it back and make sure we're...
Sure.
Yes, sir. We'll continue with that. Yes.
When, at the time in my early training, of course, the people I was in awe of course, were my instructors. And Don Garrett would be, and I would call him a hero, he was just impressive, and he was the one I wanted to emulate.
Yes, sir.
But we were totally different in regard to physique. He was a small person, where he is now, but very powerful, dynamic individual, very quiet when it comes to speech, but a very good instructor. And he had black belts in judo and aikido also.
Mm-hmm.
So our class included other arts in the way he taught it. So in our one step, for example, Yosu Sit included the jump kicks and punches, but then we had a takedown, a throw always, because we had a soft mat to throw. And so we had a lot of, what we might call judo involved in that. In our self-defense techniques, we had a lot of Aikido involved in that, especially in knife defense. And the sick form that I taught in a recent
training,
that is originally, I think, Aikido people do that. And I learned that from Don Garrett, whose highest rank he ever attained in our organization, if you call it organization at that time, was the third Don, I think. Sure. He got that from Judgment Kim the way I did mine, pretty much. He had some innovations in the way he taught it. Aikido does it more softly and without a lot of focused power, no shinjuk, no strength in the way we think of it, as like our punches, for example. It's done softly and it flows a little better and it's pretty.
Yes, sir.
But Don Garrett didn't want it to be pretty, and so the way he taught it and the way I practiced it and the way I teach it is more in attune to the way Sabakdo is practiced, with speed and power and focus, and it's a stronger form. Whether it's more realistic and more effective or not, that remains to be seen, but I think so.
Yes, sir.
So he was my, I want to say hero is the wrong word, because it's more like someone that that you feel has gone above and beyond the call of duty, and you admire them for that. And in that regard, then, my wife would fit in that category from the very beginning when she started training, because women did not do this. We didn't see any women doing this. And so she, one day, spanking the kids, or trying to, they were doing hadan maki against her action. And so she ordered them to put their hands, this is one kid or the other, I can't remember which one it was, put your hands in the bed and let me hit you. That kind of thing. And she decided then that she wanted to take martial art. And she became overnight my best student, and very easy to teach her compared to previous students that I had, but I didn't have that many anyway. And so she became a star in our area. And in competition was just magnificent. But you understand, this woman, she won 1954 Miss Sasebo contest, beauty pageant. Miss Sasebo is a city the size of San Diego. Well, I don't know where it is now, but the last time I was there, it's a big, it's a port city in southern Japan.
Yeah.
And in 1954, when she was, I don't think she was even 21 years old, she was born 35. She won this Miss Sasebo contest. I have photographs of that taken. And so it's a very good-looking woman to practice a martial art that required, especially in a tournament, at that time when the women started getting involved, it's bare knuckles. And you had a good chance of having your front teeth knocked out. So even if you were in a mouthpiece, you could get your nose broken easily.
Yes, sir.
And still today, maybe. But bare knuckles is not a thing that, if I had to do over again, I probably, in my attitude now, would not let her compete.
Yes, sir.
But back then, we were young and stupid and not really thinking about the danger of it so much, although I did worry about her a lot. She became a local champion. She was a woman to beat. And there were many women that would not enter a contest if she was going to compete and they'd back out. And so one particular time, she told them that, well, will you compete if I don't? They said they would. And so she chose not to compete and let them.
Oh.
Yeah, amazing woman. But
Things
like this girl, she was so afraid before the contest. She said, please don't hurt me. Okay. And Keiko said, don't worry, just do your best.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? You know, that's kind of a psychological blow too, see. But that's the way she was. And she says that she did that primarily to enhance my name. That's what she is. This is very Asian, you know. The husband-wife thing is like the wife will sacrifice herself forever to make sure the husband has his status, you know. And it's a kind of an unusual situation. It's no reason why I probably married her. you know. My previous girlfriends were not like that. So I got to tell you about that, you know. And that's, so she would be my hero. Even today, she's a model. And it's amazing.
Yeah, you talked about her being a champion with the sparring. I saw her do forms, which were beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Did she like to do those in
tournaments
also?
Yeah. She did very well. She loves. Now we have physical problems, both of us. She's got a bad knee. She had surgery on it, but it's one of those things that never really healed right. So now, and she has foot problems, bone spurs on the bottom of the feet that irritate her quite a bit.
Painful.
I'm getting that now.
Sure.
And so she's not as active as she used to be in that regard. She occasionally gets up and goes through some of the basics, and we do forms together. But that's about it now. You know.
Okay.
You gotta be careful.
Sure.
At her age, you know, like she's 72, I think.
Was there something else that you had thought of that you wanted to mention?
That's about it as far as heroes and people I look up to.
If we could go back to the offices that you held.
Oh, yes.
One of your offices, was there an especially challenging time? Because you were on the board for quite a while and a brand new organizational tack.
Mm-hmm. The worst time, the most difficult time was as chairman of the board in 1991, I think. We had a problem with some money we owed Grandmaster Huangqi. And we had to come up with some funds, come to about $64,000. Because we had promised earlier in our history to give him like $7 out of every membership, or $3 out of every membership fee. And the membership fee kept going up, but we still had this money back payment. So there was some pressure there with the budget. And it really all happened at once. You know, we had to send a team to England the year before and you know, that kind of thing. So we had one less newsletter. But we won't mention any names, but his initials are Master Oppo. He threatened to leave the organization at the time, and in fact resigned from the board under protest about a number of items having to do with money.
Yeah.
He didn't like the idea of having to pay that debt off, I don't think, and there were some other reasons, you know, but, like as if we couldn't afford it. We made a settlement anyway, and we did pay it off the following year. But there was a lot of pressure on me at that meeting because they were going to, there was more than one board member, they were going to stage a walkout of some kind, is what I was warned, you know. And because of several issues going down. And so I was real sleepy because Master Oppo called me at 1 o'clock to vent his frustration. And lack of sleep, I'm chairman of the board, I could run a doggone meeting. I was told by Master Marnoff, no, Messerschmidt told me that he gave me the nickname Flatliner because I appeared not to be influenced one way or the other on the issues. I did not appear to be excited or concerned about them. I just ran the meeting very systematically. Well, it was because I was a zombie, you know, so tired, you know how that goes. I just did my job. He called me Flatliner after that. Master Huang, at that time PhD chairman, he congratulated me on a very well-organized meeting. But it was only because, being a pragmatic, simple-minded person, I just kept things simple. And, you know, there was a Korean contingent there that visited, and they gave us gifts of a belt buckle with a Mudokwon emblem. Even people like Master Oppo, they kind of, like, ridiculed that, saying that was like a buy-off or something. Like that was going to excuse this other financial move, but had nothing to do with that. It was a gift, and you just take it at face value.
Yes, sir.
Somebody gives you something like that, but you know how people are sometimes. Well, it was very volatile, and there wasn't a walkout after all. The meeting went smoothly and concluded very well, I thought. It came out even at the end, and then they resigned afterward, these two members. So. I got credit for running a good meeting. That's all I care about. But let me tell you, this was not enjoyable. This
was
had me under a lot of
internally. Yes, sir.
that's the worst thing that, you know, that I went through that came out all right. Okay. I can't say what that's what it's like. It's like a good sparring match that you win.
Yes, sir.
Sometimes it was difficult, but you're so glad it's over. You know, that's it. That's about it as far as worst things. You know.
Well, what was your best time in the Mudokwan?
Best time. Oh, let me think. Wait, boy, I should have reviewed all these. There were so many good times.
We had so many.
You know, if you have one come to mind, just offhand. Favorite moments, of course. I just had one yesterday when our son looked so good. This is going to be his last competition. It was so much fun to see him look that good. Because, you know, children are. Sometimes they don't train as regularly as they should. And he's been practicing.
Yes, sir.
And he did himself proud. He's, you know, that's the way he wanted to leave. You see, then he's not going to compete anymore, he says.
Is that because, sir, he's a third guy?
It's for his own personal reasons. I think he thinks that he wants to quit while he's ahead. He doesn't want to be like some other people we know in the past that didn't quit until they were losers, you know? Well, I told him there's nothing wrong with getting old and slowing down and having younger people beat you. That's just like Rupa, it's going to happen. And but he said, no, I want to remember how good it was. And I said, well, they remember how good, so we won't mention names, how good they were when they were in their prime. We still remember that. He said, yeah, but you remember how bad they were later. So I don't want that. You know, it's a lot of, what do you call it? Ego going on there. But he did very well. He invited all his friends from the past who were there watching him.
Oh.
He had a lot of pressure to do well. Oh, God, he looked good. Oh. But anyway, that was one of my proudest moments.
Yes, sir.
Going back in time, when our daughter, oldest daughter, was still performing, and she won some contests, she really looked great. I mean, she just shined. And and when my wife won a few of those things, it makes us all feel good.
Yeah.
And I think it's so funny how when you talk about what makes you happy, it's not usually what you do, it's usually what your children do. You know?
Yes.
You find that true?
Yes, sir.
You want them to be happy, and that's why we're here. If you talk about what made you the way you are, or when people ask you who you are, I always feel like I have to start with my instructors because that's who I am, that they made me who I am. My parents, my instructors, so forth. So we got to give Don Garrett some credit for his method of training because it did me a service. And when I became a traffic officer in the Highway Patrol, there's things in the martial art that probably saved my life, the martial art training. Sometimes it's hard to say whether it did or not, but I'm sure martial art training, this martial art especially, because I've had some other influences, made me a better person. And I think it makes me able to deal with people even on these levels that we deal in law enforcement with a volatile, hostile environment.
Yes, sir.
I've always showed people respect even when they didn't deserve it. Yeah. And we're talking about some real scumbag, you know, those kind of, you know, people, like dangerous elements, criminal people, you know. But I've always kept my guard up, but yet spoke to him, you know, in a way that would bring a good response.
Yes, sir.
And I've had partners that didn't like that, the way I handled that. They thought it was strange. But it really paid off a couple of times. You had a lot of cooperation from people, you know. You tell them, you know, to do this and that in a nice way. You say, look, this is an unlawful assembly. If you don't leave now, there will be some force exerted upon you. And they leave.
Okay.
And instead of yelling at them, said, move it or we'll bust your heads, you know. You don't have to be that way.
Yes,
I think I got that from martial art training. Jumped around a little bit too much.
No, sir. No, sir. We're fine. Do you have a photograph or remember a photograph that has special meaning for you?
Boy, you asked some good ones. Let me think. Well, of course, the first photograph that I had taken of me with Grandmaster Huang Ki. He's a nice one. It doesn't reproduce well. It's in color, you know how that goes in it, but it's a snapshot.
Yes.
And a couple of photographs with Howard Jackson when he was with me, you know, those are kind of special for me. Those good old days, you know.
Sure.
And what's another one? Photograph. You know, the we were talking about martial art things primarily, but you know, there's other things from the past. My wife and I, she has it with her, a picture of when we were dating. And we were so skinny and scary. I weighed 175 at that time. She weighed 100 pounds maybe.
Oh.
It's amazing. But, and she had a beehive here. You know.
I remember those. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, for so and, those photographs are pretty neat. And,
yes, sir.
Photographs of my my youngest son when he was a baby, and my my oldest son when he was my first student, actually. We gave our students dub numbers our own. We didn't have a system of federation to give them to us, and so Michael was my first student. I gave him number one, and Brenda was the one I taught Basai. I gave her number two as my second student, but technically, she probably should have been my first and best student because she's older.
Yes, yes, sir.
But I think I started showing Michael how to defend himself early. So he's my first student. He, I'm proud of him in those days. I have some pictures of him. When he was a very good fighter. His form was so-so.
Mm-hmm.
He did forms like he was fighting, which is not bad, but it's not real good form.
Yes, sir.
And he had really good technique, actually. Not real flexibility either, but technique. You know, Teddy had it all from the beginning because he didn't, you know, he had the Federation then, maybe the proper methods of teaching and methods that we didn't have later on. I mean early on.
Yes, sir.
Very limited in those days, sir. The way we taught her was funny, you know, with no curriculum, you know, just our own. You watch that spine and just kind of like made up stuff as you went along. You did techniques you wanted to practice. The closest thing to a system I ever came across was a recommendation by my second instructor. The Korean instructor told me to take moves out of the form, out of the yum, and put them in your one yosusik. That wasn't a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did that. It was kind of funny to do a block a punch with a backhand and then come and do a crescent kick into your palm right in front of the person's face.
Oh.
Because it looked and sounded like you hit the person in the head.
Yes, yeah, sir.
You're slapping your hand right about here.
Yes, sir.
And we did things like that. You know.
That's creative.
We had to be, I guess.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Such
yes,
a nice change, though, when we started being, you know, given clinics by the present-day Kwantanim. These clinics, every time you went to them, people experienced some more than we, because you were closer to them than us.
Yes, sir.
But every time we had a Don test, it was a clinic. So we had two of these clinics and Don tests a year. And he taught them, and some really good things came our way then. He said, holy cow, got things to work on. And it really paid off in funny ways, too. The technique, I won't even mention it, but what it was, but he taught a technique in 1978 in Santa Barbara. And at a Kodansha test I had in 1980-something, he was about to teach this technique, and the way he did it was, now, what would you do if such and such happened? And I raised my hand and said, I would do a pichagi. It has to do with a, after a crescent kick is blocked, after you do a hakesu onuro chagi,
that's
defended,
yeah,
then you drop your foot to the floor and come out with a short familiar chagi. It's an outside crescent kick or a pichagi. He said, lose your shot because that was what you're going to teach. And he said, how'd you know that? I said, you taught me that form in that method in 1978. He said, oh, he says, you have a good memory. I said, not necessarily. I've been practicing ever since. It's a good technique, so I practice it. That's all. I won't mention all the things. I didn't tell him all the things I stopped, didn't practice. But that one I liked so much. I said, hey, I took it back to my students. And, it's an outside crescent kick with a dirty target. That's it. And it's a real short round kick because you're so close.
Yes, sir.
And
yes, sir.
It's fun to teach. can still do it, too, which is nice. In spite of the other problems we have.
Yes, sir.
That's about it.
Great. Yes. All right. Do you have a treasured item from your training?
Well, I mentioned the ID card.
Yes, sir, that's right.
I can send that to you digitally, too. I'll take a picture of it and mail it.
Oh, that would be good, sir.
No problem.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's one of my treasures. There's some other things besides the photographs at that time. There are some handout materials, some papers that were given to us when we were white belts that gave us a background of the art and the methods, you know, basically one and two. They called primary form number one was Geichiri no Myobu.
Oh.
And then they had primary form number two was Geichiri no Myobu, and so forth. And the history of it was brief, but it was funny. They didn't call Grandmaster Huang Ki anything other than either Professor Huang Ki or Master Huang Ki. His rank was eighth dan in that literature.
Yes, sir.
And we were told, and it's in the writing, I have it, I can mail it to you.
Yes,
it was kind of interesting to read.
Yes, sir.
They said, our art is called Tong Sido, and there are two divisions of Tong Sido. One is the Mudaquan, and one of the other is Subak Do. And we belong to the Mudaquan branch.
Oh.
So it actually was like all kinds of things going on. It was 1964.
Yes, sir.
So 1964, we had a lot of misinformation or misinterpretation of what was happening in Korea.
Yes, sir.
Even though we had a Korean to tell us at that time. I didn't train directly under Lee Jung Hyun, but my teacher did. So.
Yes, sir.
So yeah, see that, believe it. It's just I don't know where where it come from and how how come it's so distorted from what we're told now. But that's the way things happen.
Yes, sir.
I got that. I didn't throw that away.
Oh.
It includes also my little your doodles. I doodle the direction of the form with lines. So I'm here and all that. Like little eye-shaped thing. With I see people do that. I laugh. I said, I did the same thing.
Same thing.
I still have it.
Did we talk about your first meeting with Huang Zheng and H. C. Wong?
Oh, no. We didn't have a photograph of that, too. The first time I met him was at the board meeting in 1978. Yeah. In L.A. As a new board member. The first communication we had was by mail, and he was still calling himself Jin Moon Huang at the time. And he wrote me a letter when I first started becoming a member of this new federation. It was not really formed yet. So I joined the Korean Subak Do through him by way to Korea. Register and sent him a copy of the certificate that I had from Jae Jun Kim, and then they gave me a copy, they gave me a certificate for third dan in the Subak Do Korean, and that was more official, and explained that my dan number that was given to me by Jae Jun Kim was dan number 6,000 something, but that was not, didn't fit in with the numbering system. The Don number I got from Don Garrett was like number six.
Yes.
It was a six, I was a sixth student. He was already broken away from. The Don number that Don Garrett was given by Lee Jung Hyun was 5991. Yes, I got it right. And that was bogus. That was Lee Jung Hyun just started issuing Don numbers. But Don Garrett never joined the federation that we have. When it was forming, he was not interested in kind of like he faded away, and I'm not sure why, but he had a strong dislike, distrust of most of Koreans because of Lee Jung Hyun. But I tried to explain, they're not all alike. I said, it's like one American crook out of 100 good people, come on. So, my treasure items, aside from that. Every once in a while I come across other things. That's what it is. I have a copy of the suggested, there was a time when the Federation was being formed where I wanted a patch. And we had a patch contest, a design contest.
Oh.
I have a copy of my submitted
Yes.
It looks like this.
Yes, sir.
But the difference is, I didn't use Korean letters. I didn't use Korean words. I had United States of Boston, or Tongsiro, Budapon.
Yes, sir.
The coloring is similar, as I recall, because I remember we knew the colors, what the colors had to be.
Yes.
And I have a copy of that. I enlarged it from that. I didn't win the contest. I don't think anyone did. But my suggestion was really...
Very close.
Yeah. So at least it gave somebody an idea.
Yes, sir.
The fish itself, the emblem, I took off a rubber stamp that I used for purposes that I had made, for posters. And I used that design. And that design of fist, and I collect those, by the way, I have tons of those. Different Mudokon emblems through the years. I got maybe 40 or 50 of them. The ones that were used back when in all these different organizations that are Mudokon, or say they are or not. And I have them mostly identified, also foreign organizations. In early times, it didn't seem to be any regulation how many leaves are supposed to be there. So some have 13, some have 17. It's really kind of funny. Oh. So Nathaska and Kwantanyami says it's supposed to be 14th in the beginning.
Oh.
But they, some people didn't count very well.
You said that you had met Kwan Jae-min HC1 at a board meeting.
Yes.
Do you have any favorite stories about him and you or your time together?
Hmm. Well, let's see. Not at the board meeting so much, it's just that, you know, he knew my instructor, my career instructor. Okay?
Yes, he knew me.
He knew my instructor real well. And so that was the connection we had. And there was another connection with the Argentine fellow that trained with me a short time when he was back east and training with him. Roberto Villalba is his name. He's now in Rome somewhere. He's not in our organization. There was a situation where Kwantanyam cut his foot real bad on a technique where you kick an apple off of a knife.
Yes, sir.
I didn't see this, but I heard about it. And it's something I've seen other people do. And he cut himself so bad he couldn't proceed. And so Roberto got out there and did a weapons form that I had taught him with a sword. And Kwantanyam, at that time, was the son of Kwantanyam, asked him where he learned that. And he said, well, Mr. Mason taught it to me. So I'm getting all these little gloves and kudos and things from other people, and we hadn't met yet. So in the letter, he said he couldn't wait to meet me at the board meeting, and so we met, and we got along fine, and you know, there goes. But as far as funny experiences, the memorable thing or wonderful thing, in my test that I passed for Fourth Dan, there were people on that board that, you know, there's a lot of friction and maybe even a competitive spirit, we call it in a nice way, based upon jealousy, envy, greed, whatever.
Whatever.
They didn't want me to pass. Okay. I'll mention their names. And he overrode their decision, and he told me what he told them. And he said, sometimes, and I've used this quote many times since, sometimes a good attitude is better than a good kick, anytime. Sometimes attitude is most important. And he said, my attitude was good. And he told me that outside. He said, don't worry about these other people. He said, you don't have to work with them real close. But they're in our organization, so you've got to get along.
Mm-hmm.
He said, that kind of thing. He said, as long as you get along with each other, we'll have a good organization. But he said, don't let them bother you.
Mm-hmm.
Just do as you've been doing, because you have good students, and a good reputation, you'll be okay. And those people are no longer with our organization anymore. That's three of them.
Yes, sir.
And, so, glad.
I know you had already talked about our founder, you know, and when you met him, mm-hmm. and we went over that, mm-hmm. too. So besides our founder and Kwan Jeng Lim H.C. Wong, if you had to choose a memorable person of all the people you've met, who do you think you'd pick?
Mm.
Somebody who made an impression on you.
So many have, you know, so many have. Favorable, you know. I'm sure you don't know that. But, you know, because Don Jerry really impressed me with his ability.
Yes, sir.
And, I can't think of anyone off the top of my head that did like that.
Did he pass on any traditions that you still have today in your training or teaching?
Yeah, I don't know. See, there's so many things that he taught are no longer practiced in the Federation the way we did them then. Whether it's his way that he, you know, or was taught that way, I don't know. But a little bit of time, I had to make those changes to come into line with what the Federation wants us to do. And so a little bit of time, there's not much left of the way I used to be taught. I see it in the old films that other people taught that way too.
Mm-hmm.
Things as mundane as ready for kicking. Lachagi Chumbi was not with your fists up like in a sparring position. It was with the fists out in front and low by doing kapkwan, hadan kapkwan kongo. That was the way you got ready for kicking.
And were you in the form of chungo jase, but out like
this? Yes, a little bit in front. That's what, and you see it in the tape. I have a video of the way they were doing it back then in Korea. That's what they were doing. Yeah. When you come to attention, about this. When you come to attention, you know, this is an old tradition to stop doing it. When you come to attention like this, it's almost very, like this, hands open. Okay? That's attention.
Never seen that.
Yeah. When you did Chungi, like this, we wound up like this, and this pigeon toe. Sometimes we don't do that anymore. I was the last one in California to change from this. And this thing here, and the block from armpit. Things like a little bit of time. We're not doing any of that anymore. But maybe one thing held over is just some of the techniques in self-defense. I do the Hoshin school that the Federation wants me to teach. I teach that, and then I teach the other things that I learned from Don Deere. That still remains. We'll call that extra technique or additional technique or another way to do it.
And that's the one that had the Aikido in it? Or
I believe so. I believe it's Aikido-based, yeah. Because Master Martinoff still teaches it that, because he has an Aikido background also.
Yes, sir.
His Aikido teacher is really a wonderful man. I met him at the birthday party. He plays flamenco guitar also. So I got to play flamenco guitar up there at the birthday party for him, you know, more or less. He's got an injury that he can't play guitar right now. And we got a long time.
I'll put that in. So, from what areas you're training now do you get the most satisfaction?
Oh yeah, I love to teach. I've always liked to teach, and I enjoy teaching things that students enjoy learning. So the things that lately have been mostly clinics that cover either a form that they never learned before, or self-defense techniques, or we have local clinics in Region 9 twice a year that superseded the Moment with the Masters concept. And it raises money for the region. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy teaching those because sometimes they really click. I mean, things, I do the research and all the time, and I'm always trying to learn new things. But when I'm able to teach that in a nice way, in the best way possible, I really get a kick out of that, and the students do. You know,
that's
the students receive it. say, well, then I really like it. We had a, accidentally or on purpose once, so we had a, some techniques that I learned from Don Garrett mixed in with some recent things from Master Cyberly, defense in the, from the floor. And Master Cyberly saw me teaching this method, and he told me his way was similar, but it added to it. The information was added to it. So now I had this one-hour class I could teach on floor defense, and then another hour Master Messersmith took over grappling. And it, those two classes back-to-back were just so complete together. It was a kind of an interesting, it was a beautiful continuation of the subject. It was like, first you're on the floor defending, and then later he's on top of you, and now you got to wrestle, if that's the right word, you know, grapple. And so the two, our two classes back-to-back, you could see the students were like, this is great.
Yes, sir.
Because it all blended into something that worked really from one level to another. And I like it when that clicks like that. And every time you teach, you streamline and things get better and better. You know, I like that. And when, in researching a subject, I learned so much researching on a simple subject that all of a sudden expands into something else. I learned maybe 7 ways to draw a bow now. And any one source I have doesn't have all 7 or 8, whatever. You know, we got these things and these things and these things, and then we have the Asian way and another Asian way.
Oh.
Yeah, it goes on and on. The Mongolian goes on, and it's so fun. And I discovered this one in doggone artwork. They're shown depicted in a 17th century depiction of some combat. People drawing a bow in this war, and you can see that the artist has drawn them with this finger sticking out, but this thumb is obviously being used as a Mongolian bow should be used instead of doing this. This is standard today in Turkish and Mongolian and Korean and Japan. This is the way they draw their bow. They wear a thumb ring, and the string hooks on the thumb ring, or they use a glove, and that's the Mongolian way. So in teaching a class on Hwarang, the Hwarang Do, whatever, you got to include that because they're very good archers. And so I'm researching this and I'm stumbling onto all these different things. I said, wow! You know, well, then I get to pass it on to the students. And my wife warns me, as Master Wong also, Grandmaster told me this, you don't have to tell them you just learned it. Leave that part out. Just tell them this is what you know. But I'm really too honest for my own good. If I just learn something, I want to pass it on.
Yes,
it's like you find gold, you got to yell Eureka, whatever. Jeez, you know.
Yes, sir.
And that's the way I am. And she said, my wife, take time. Don't tell them everything. You know. Just tell them what you want to tell them. Don't tell them. But I want to tell them this.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And that's one of my weaknesses, maybe being too honest. You know, too forward. I don't know. That's me. You know, take it or leave it, right?
Has your, I think maybe you probably talked about this, but has your approach to your own training changed over the years?
Had to be, yes.
Had to be.
Yeah. Got to be careful what I do now. And so my approach is to do what I can and as best I can. But I have some problems in time spent to train. You know, I put off training when I shouldn't because of other, I put off doing things that I shouldn't do. I mean, I should do them right away, but I'll do that tomorrow. And, you know, I'm doing that lately more and more. And then when I go to do it, I'm not as prepared as I should be. But mostly that's because I don't have to be prepared so much in that way. But it comes back to bite you when you go to demonstrate a technique and you haven't done it for a while, you know. It's tough. You know? Especially like you go to Kodansha, you're not ready, you're in deep trouble, you know. But my memories give me back. So I forget like parts of Hyung, or when I'm teaching them, I leave things out. I just did that in New Jersey just recently. That one staff form I left.
Oh, yeah.
about three moves out of that thing. I don't know what happened. It's like, it's just gone. And I get, you know, I send emails to these people that gave the email address, so I could send them the whole thing in writing. And that's when I saw it. Moving them 19/20/21, I let down. How'd that happen? Maybe subconsciously, I just didn't want to do it.
Didn't want to do that.
Or maybe we just want to shorten the form somewhat and get.
Yes, sir. This is a time issue.
Yeah, that maybe.
Yes, sir.
Honestly,
yes.
I just forgot.
What do you think is the most important thing a senior person in the Mulquan can contribute to the juniors?
I think, and we have done this, probably one of the most important things is let them learn from our experiences, let them, like our children, say, don't do what I did in this way, because that doesn't work. Do it this way, and you'd be better off than we were, because we did it the hard way. It was on and on. I'm not talking about everything from studio operation. You know, they want to open up a studio downtown in a higher end district right away. Start small, build, and then you can move up, move on downtown or whatever. Yeah. Things like that. That kind of advice I tell my students this too. You know, young people don't listen very well to things like that. But you know, it's important that they know that when we did those things, it was incorrect. A lot of us old timers maybe have fun talk about the good old days, but they weren't that good. They were. We were ignorant of a lot of things, and so we did things the hard way, and some of us got hurt doing them. And pain is a good teacher, but you don't want to cripple yourself, you know. So I warn people, like the stretches. We do ballistic stretches. We throw our leg in the air and see how far it'll go, and pretty soon it's flying up in the air, and we're and that's the way we were taught. And so we passed that on, and I said, no. This is much better off doing it slow and easy at first, and kind of gradually build up to it, make sure you're warmed up first. And like, you know, we did the stretches before warm-ups when I was a beginner. Stretches were part of the warm-ups. We didn't really warm up. We were stretching.
Stretching.
Not a warm-up. But that's, you know, we're kind of, everything was backwards. We had water discipline. We said it was not good to drink water during class. It was a matter of discipline not to. After is okay. And so that didn't enhance our ability.
Sure.
It hurt us physically, you know. And so
sure.
I lose 6 pounds of moisture in a class, an hour and a half. I remember weighing myself before class and after, 5 to 6 pounds every class. And then of course the water tasted really good after class.
Yes, sir.
But there should have been more breaks in there, every half hour maybe, to chug some water. And we were told in those days it would give you cramps or something if you drank water and then worked out. But the contrary, it's the opposite. It's if you don't drink water, that's the worst kind of cramp. You might get some stomach sloshing around and everything, you know, thing, but that's not going to hurt you. You know, a lot of things, I think the seniors have a lot of that to offer. We probably had more fun telling them about the way things were done in the old days because it's so different now.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I don't mind telling them about that if it means anything to them. I don't mind talking about that now.
Yes, sir.
I don't know. It might be. Well, you like the rock, breaking rocks is, I realize now, I didn't realize it much of it. You know, not a lot of people didn't know that we did that.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know nationwide what we're doing, though. I can't speak for others. But I saw things like in literature that was handed out from those places, like from Detroit to New York, photographs and statements made by stuff in Black Belt magazine, that there was something similar going on in every place else too. Not a lot of them. You know, and they were all doing the same things we were, kind of. You know, but every instructor is different.
Do you have any story with a moral that you like to tell your students? Any particular story?
Yeah. You're asking the wrong man. I have too many stories. You know that part too.
Well, you could tell a couple.
Okay.
That would be fine.
Okay, here's one. There is a tradition in the Kiowa tribes that before you enter a cave, you and this is an ancient tradition, is probably gone by the wayside. But before you enter a cave, and they had different things, different incantations, you chant before battle, before you get in the water with a canoe. There's a, like a prayer, but it's a song. And they sing this song to the spirits of the waters, or the spirits of the cave, to appease them before going into the water, you know, before going into a cave. The story goes, a young Kiowa hunter following the tracks of a deer into a cave, but he's hot on his trail. He totally ignores the custom, tradition, and enters the cave after this deer, and is killed by a grizzly bear who slept there. Moral of the story is, some tradition has value.
Yes, sir.
Because you could have woke the doggone bear up, and that might be that you reached the purpose.
Yes, sir.
Before you get go in a dark cave. You're like, ooh.
That's good, sir. Yeah.
That's one of my favorites. Because kids, you know, tradition, you know, tradition. We're talking about tradition, you know. What good is it? What good is it? That's it. There's a reason for everything.
Great.
That's
great,
one of my favorites.
Sir. Yes, sir.
And it's off the top of my head, but you know, like the guy said, I have a million of them.
Yes, sir.
We're trying to come up with several that fit each of the things, like the Mudo values and other aspects. And I was working on them, and that was one that I had come across within this past year. My wife said, you shouldn't tell people that you just learned it. But, so, I mean, this is your challenge.
Yes, sir. Great. Yes, sir.
I added a few things. It's like that in today's society, having to do with respect for people is one that this really happened. My a friend of mine, nice Jewish kid, I said, you're a tradition, okay? He calls me, I won't say his name, because there's probably a lot of people by the same name, but I was in the army with this fellow. And we weren't the best of friends, but because we're in the army together, we ran across each other, recognized each other somewhere downtown, and we struck up a conversation and exchanged phone numbers and, you know, something to do with, we were young and single then, and we were thinking about, well, you know, if you know any good parties, let me know. And because the Jewish people throw some really good parties, and I wanted to be invited to those. But he called me one day, years after we were both married, and he said, I got a problem. He said, my father is dying, and he wants me to come and say this prayer. It's an old Hebrew song prayer. That's an ancient tradition in the Orthodox faith of their, you know, the Jews. He didn't practice Orthodox. He's a Reform, and really not really that much active anyway. But he didn't want to do it because he didn't like his father. His father and him didn't get along. He didn't approve of his marriage, that kind of thing, you know. He might have married outside of the Jewish faith, that's another thing. And so he asked me what I thought, because I think enjoyed my insight to things outside of his customs. And we got along fine. I was a really good soldier in the Army. I knew things that he didn't know about the Army, so I took off kissing ROTC in high school.
Oh, yeah.
So I gave him some advice that saved him in peacetime. There's no war. So that was it. That's our connection. So he said, what do you think I should do? Because my father and I hated each other. I said, he's your father. I said, say the prayer. Do you want to cross your fingers behind your back or something? You know, it's your father. He's dying. Yeah, I think you should say the prayer. Mm-hmm. And he said, I don't even know them. Like you like mm-hmm. prayer. I said, I'm sure they'll give it to you. They can read the thing and say it. And I always joke with them that I was related to Jackie Mason. There was not true, but the comedian?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's my connection also. And so when I gave him this kind of advice, I said, say the prayer. What can you lose? Well, he didn't say the prayer. His father's died and disinherited him. His sister got everything. We're talking about $1 million worth of widow material, okay? Plus, I think he said more than a million. we'll leave it a million right now, whatever it was. And now, and then he calls me and said how irritated his father's, again, pissed him off even after death. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, you had your chance. Mm-hmm. That was the time. I said, I could think right now, I could think of a million reasons why you should have said the prayer. And, you know, some things are so logical. It goes beyond tradition. It goes to doing the right thing,
yes,
period.
Yes,
and sometimes you have to weigh what's right. In this instance, what is the right thing? Okay, I don't care if you hate your father or not. There's something there that goes beyond personal feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of discipline. Sure. Mr. Wong would agree with that.
Sure.
I'm thinking, yeah, that's another story I tell to adults. I tell them a story about how this guy screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, right or wrong, it has nothing to do with money. I think it's the principle.
Yes, sir. Yeah, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes. I would have said prayer.
Sir, what would you want students to know about you, or how would you like to be remembered?
Well, someone asked me that recently. A young student of mine, doing an essay thing for school, mm-hmm. high school kid, he asked me what my legacy would be. And I told him my legacy is my students. I couldn't think of anything else at the time. But how to be remembered is another thing. You know, I've always wanted to do a videotape to have it played at my funeral. She's too humorous for a funeral, but I just like to say, I really hate funerals, you know, especially this one. I would like to be remembered as being someone who tried to do the right thing, you know, for better or for worse. You know. And who probably had a good sense of humor. I don't know. I never thought about that too much. Like what I want to put on my gravestone might not have to be very much other than, you know, the standard thing, you know. Husband, father, and other ones. I'm hoping I was a good father. Had been, you know. So far so good as far as the kids turning out. That makes me happy, you know.
Good.
As far as a good husband, I'm gonna have to talk to Keiko. You know. I don't know whether I deserve that or not, but you remember that's interesting. Yeah, like Caitlin said, they're going to miss you when you're gone. Yeah, they miss you too. Yeah, they miss both of us. She's worried about this family trust fund. She wants me to get that going. Because you don't want the burden on our children to have to worry about this. So the sword and the gun collection goes to the son, and the diamonds and rubies and jewels and goes to the daughter. Like, the two daughters, that's a problem.
Yes, sir.
Well, yeah, I think you're covered.
Okay.
Good. Right.
Is there anything else you wanted to say? Anything we didn't cover? Or if you think about something, I'll be carrying this around Sunday.
Okay.
Tomorrow or whatever. We can put a little extra on.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, great.
I enjoy it.
Okay, we're back on. Yes.
Ian. This fella, Roberto Villalba, visited our country in 1973-4, something like that. He was a Taekwondo man from Mar del Plata, Argentina, which is in the super south of their country. He had connections and more or less was the president of a martial art group that had studios throughout the country, the Taekwondo studios. And a very dynamic personality, or the character, you know, super loud individual. He read a letter I wrote to the editor of Black Belt Magazine discussing the situation in Korea and the way, you know, it had something to do with the forums and stuff. And this letter was read at the first meeting of the Federation. I wasn't there. But this is the kind of thing they said they wanted more publicity, that they wanted us to be visible. And as I complained about certain things in the way the Korean government treated Moodle Kwan and Wong Ki and everybody else.
Yeah.
And as I invented, just before word processors that I had control of, and I know what cut and paste was because I took scissors and had to cut this and rearrange thoughts because I I wrote it in a kind of a scatterbrained way, because it's the way I talk. You know, just, I rewrote that damn letter a dozen times. And they corrected my spelling. Black Belt Magazine, there was one thing I spelled wrong, and they, oh, thank you, thank you. I caught it after it was too late. And so he read this letter while he was in L.A., very dissatisfied with the instruction he received. This is a thing by mail. He found this taekwondo instructor in L.A., and a great expense to his organization. They sent him up here to learn new forms and get a promotion test. And he was on the edge of suicide because he had nothing really of great value to bring back. So he read this letter in I think it was Karate Illustrated then. And he got a hold of me, and he asked to come and see me. And he came to our school, watched me teach. He said, "You will not believe this, but I teach exactly like you do, only in Spanish." I didn't use Korean terminology then, right?
Yes.
Before the Federation. So he moved to Oceanside in an apartment and lived there for a month and trained with me. And we didn't have tape. We filmed it with Super 8, our forms, up to the rank that he was at. I think the highest rank, maybe Chindo. Chindo and the Hanchi, 1 and 2, something like that. Could have gone further, but you know, that's the tape. That's the things he brought back to his country. And he writes to me afterward, and he writes just like he talks, flamboyant. She didn't have room in the paper for that. He said, "Hola, Che, ¿qué tal?" He said, "Hey, hello, brother, how are you?" And then the rest is in English. God. He says, "All these studios changed to Tuxedo this day." He was a dictator. He admits that. Peronus, he was all for Peron in those days, you know. A little bit of Nazi type character. Degree in philosophy from the University of Buenos Aires. So because of them, they became Tongsido Mudokwon, because of this visit, because of him. I get credit for that. He called me El Padrino del Tongsido, the godfather of Tongsido in Argentina.
Yes.
Oh, lovely. So he, then Grandmaster, present day Grandmaster, gets a hold of this information, and of course he lived there for a while and trained with him, Roberto did.
Oh.
And so Argentina now has got this contingent because of this connection. Wonderful. And then I never did visit Argentina until 1999. Grandmaster was going down there and having a celebration. Their federation is older than ours because they started right away. They started in 1975, 74, as soon as he went home. Technically, ours started in 75. Even though they keep announcing 76. And I don't know how to get that wrong. Anyway, so I went there in 1999, and then when I teach a clinic, and I got to tell you this as I have to, you know, I come around the corner in this car to go to the studio to teach a clinic that night after I had some rest, and there's a banner across the entire street that says, "Welcome, Ted Mason." Where's the billion? Jeez. I said, never in my country, you know. I said, you know, in my country, that's illegal. You can't do that. He said, "Here, Cuba, you have to catch us." Okay. So I got a picture of it on the way back.
Yes.
Taught the clinic. Then we, you know, long story short, we end up in Mar del Plata, which is quite a way south from Buenos Aires. And Grandmaster taught us clinic on the Huddy. And I had a deja vu experience there too, by the way. Better than that, I had a nirvana. Do you know why we do, you know what you do in middle punch going this way, where you turn, you do haramaki?
Yes, sir.
You ever wonder why we don't do a middle punch turning?
Yes, sir.
I've wondered. High punch, you do turn, you do low defense?
Yes, sir.
Well, I've always wondered, and the joke in my studio is, when I make Grandmaster, as if I will change that. But I discovered that day in Mar del Plata during that clinic. Why? Because in his clinic, he teaches, "Hey, you're doing this stuff, right? And we turn like this and like this." But when you're doing the punch thing, you're doing the hip point forward.
Yes, sir.
When you turn, it's very difficult to turn all the way around this way.
Yes, sir.
So you don't. You just go ahead and do this. And it came to me and said, "That's it. That's why it's done that way." And so I want to scream, you know, like, it's like the other things I mentioned.
Eureka.
I found Eureka. I found it. And that day. Well, after he finished teaching, he divided up the group into Don's, Red Belt's, kids, three of them. And Cash Cooper was there. He's teaching one corner, like, you know. I got the Don's, just, you know, because I was a little senior, probably, you know. I got an interpreter there that considers himself my student. Roberto's no longer in Argentina. He's in Rome, so. And he's not with anything connected to us anymore. He's his own guy. Anyway, that's the way they go. So, I'm teaching a class, make a long story short. Start with the form. We do it by the numbers, and then I talk. We do it without the numbers first, you know. So the interpreter. We did that several times, made several corrections, and then somebody in the front row, some senior, Codanja level, asked the question, who am I? I wasn't introduced.
Oh.
And so I didn't realize it was important. My interpreter, I'm sorry, I forgot to introduce you. So he tells him, this is Ted Mason. Yes. So then I told him, I said, well, you know, even Jesus said he wasn't a prophet is not respected in his own hometown.
Yes, sir.
And he wasn't, when he went back to Nazarene, right? He was a Nazarene. Yes. And so even he said that, and they all laughed. You know, they're all Christian Catholic types.
Yes.
And I said, it's funny, because I don't get this kind of response in my country. I really, really appreciate your hospitality.
Oh.
You've been very good to me, and I'm just passing on to you what I have learned from him, from Quantinem. At that time, he wasn't Quantinem. So I gave him all the credit for this, but I said, I'm teaching you, because I know there's so many differences, just like here. You know, anyway, that's my favorite connection there. So I'm a godfather of Don Chido. Of course, now they call it Sabato, too.
Yeah.
Very good group of people, and I really, really like them a lot. I like to go back with Keiko to enjoy that kind of attention, too, you know.
Yes.
She doesn't like to travel that far unless it's to a home country.
Yes.
So I thought I'd throw it on.
Thank you.
It's,